The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week we're looking at what happens in our brains when we're in the grip of passion. Both physical and emotional. We're joined by science writer Kate Sukel. Kate holds a BS in cognitive psychology from Carnegie Mellon University and an MS in engineering psychology from the Georgia Institute of Technology. We'll be talking about her book, Dirty Minds, How Our Brains Influence Love, Sex, and Relationships. And one more thing. We'll be discussing the neuroscience of sexuality and the physical causes of those reactions in a good bit of detail. So, if there are small children around and you don't want to have that lengthy conversation with them quite yet, you've been warned. Thanks for listening. And now, here's Kate Sukel. So, why? Why this book?
Well, this is the sad part of the fairy tale. I was actually getting a divorce, and I think, like many people, whenever you start having marital problems, people start throwing books at you. All kinds of great self-help books. But for me, the more I read them, the more I thought, gosh, there's just nothing in here for me. Today's self-help books always sort of mention science. They make little statements about how you may be having trouble in a relationship because you have too much testosterone working in your brain, or perhaps you don't have enough oxytocin. And as I read them, you know, they would just sort of make these vague statements. I wondered, what does that even really mean? And so since I have this background in neuroscience, I thought, maybe since I'm not finding the answers in these books, maybe there's actually something in the literature, the scientific literature, that can help me out and understand this whole, you know, big bad love thing.
Well, one of the things that I liked so much about the book is that you are very clear as to the speculative nature of a lot of this research.
Yes. You know, we're so coached to expect prescriptive advice from science. You know, we pick up women's magazines or those self-help books, or even, you know, after watching a television show, and science is supposed to give us these 12 easy steps to happiness, or five, or what have you, rules to follow, guidelines to adhere to. And the science really isn't there yet. It's not only just that it's a new field, and it's really not even as new as people might think, because back in the day, scientists were looking at things like pair bonds and parenting behavior. They just would have never characterized it as love. But, you know, it's becoming more and more clear that, especially when you're talking about interpersonal relationships, there are layers of complexity that we're only just beginning to understand. So saying that there's one way to love or one way to have a relationship, it's not even being skeptical. It's just plain wrong.
Well, why don't we start by talking a bit about the history of brain science?
Sure.
What were some of the early ideas around the brain and what it was responsible for?
If you go back to the time of Plato and Aristotle, there was actually quite a big debate about whether the brain or the heart was sort of the seat of the mind, whether intelligence, morality, et cetera, was in, you know, in your head or your heart. I think in some ways we're still having that debate, although
Indeed.
Not quite in the same way. So many people thought the heart is it, you know, that it's not just pumping blood, it's what's responsible for all of our passions, and the brain is there to cool us. But there was this great guy, Galen. He happened to be a Roman surgeon that worked with gladiators. And I'm guessing he got a pretty good look at what a good blow to the head could do to not just bodily function, but personality. And he was one of the first to really put forward the idea that, no, it's the brain. It's the brain that's sort of in charge of just about everything. You can link almost all behavior, thought, morality, et cetera, back to what is essentially a big bag of chemicals in our skulls.
Well, one of the early brain science methods was phrenology. And
yes.
Do tell.
It was sort of the right idea, but the wrong application. So phrenologists believe that if you just sort of ran a deft hand over the skull, you could learn a lot about people. In fact, you could know anything that you needed to know about their personality. Studious people had big buggy eyes, so that areas of the brain that were responsible for studiousness and intelligence, they resided back there. If you were a good lover and good marriage material, the back of your head, the occiput, was the area that was going to sort of push out. And they really believed that there was localization of function. And of course, we do still believe in localization of function today. But they thought by just understanding the topography of any person's skull, they could tell you what they were like as a person. Of course, there are a few problems with phrenology. One, some of these areas that they were linking to things like friendship or flexibility weren't actually parts of the brain. They might be sinuses or nerves or, far, far away from actually any gray matter. But also, there's a lot more to the brain than what's, right under the skull. So sort of the right idea, wrong methodology. I think it had become clear from people like Broca and Wernicke and lots of early sort of neuropsychologists that brain damage showed, this localization of function. But you're not going to find it just from kind of doing a once-over on the head.
So then when we're talking about the neurobiology of love, that also sounds a bit far-fetched, but is it?
It's a good question, and it's one that scientists were asking themselves. Sue Carter, who is this brilliant woman who works with prairie voles, looking at a chemical called oxytocin, one that you may have heard of because it's in the news all the time these days. It's called the cuddle chemical. Back in the early 90s, she had already been working with oxytocin. It's a little neuropeptide, and she had been working with her rodent model. And she put in a grant proposal to keep doing the work. After she submitted it, she got this review that accused her of studying love. And she said that when she got that review back, she sort of felt like she got sucker punched. She had not mentioned love in the grant proposal whatsoever. She made it clear that she was studying prairie voles, very small mouse-like rodents, not human beings. And nowhere was she suggesting that anything that she was looking at had any kind of applicability to humans. So it sort of started a fire under her, and it made her wonder, well, okay, maybe the reason why I'm getting so upset about this is because they have a point. Maybe there is something, in these pair bonding studies and looking at oxytocin and, looking at parenting behaviors that does apply to humans. And so she and another oxytocin researcher named Kirsten Uvnäs Mogberg, who was over in Sweden at the Karolinska Institute, had a symposium come together, invited some of the best and brightest neuroscientists of the time to come debate whether or not there was a neurobiology of love. They came away from the meeting saying, yes, indeed, there is. And it sort of gave a green light to many of these scientists to start calling love by its true name. So instead of avoiding it like the dirty, dirty word it is, they could finally sort of start speculating about what was happening in rats and in prairie voles. And at that point, even starting to talk about what was happening in the human genome might actually have something to do with how human beings connect.
Well, and two of the people that were really pioneers in this field as well were Helen Fisher and Andreas Bartel. So maybe talk a bit about their work.
Yes. Andreas Bartel was a graduate student of a researcher at University College London named Samir Zeki. Samir Zeki calls himself a neuroestheticist. And what sort of prompted him, and of course his graduate student, Andreas Bartel, to start thinking, well, maybe there is some kind of common underlying neural substrate for love. Maybe this is something that we can actually see in a neuroimaging study. Basically, Zeki was inspired by literature and art and music. Thinking back to my own college days, this bad, bad boy gave me this Frank O'Hara poem called To the Harbor Master. And, the imagery is all about boats and getting tied up and stuck in the weeds and trusting the strength of a vessel. It's basically saying he's going to break my heart. But, oh my gosh, is that a hot poem. It's very clear, even though he's talking about a boat, he's talking about something else.
Right.
And it's a poem that can really sort of grab you and you have a physical reaction to it. There's a reason why things like Romeo and Juliet, when done well, not necessarily by Baz Luhrmann, can grab us in such a way. There's a reason why, you know, a poem by Rumi or Margaret Atwood just gets under our skin. And he said, because of those commonalities, there must be shared biology. We wouldn't feel the same way about music and poems and art if there wasn't some common biology there. So although it is kind of debated of who had the idea first, let's stick people who claim to be madly in love in the brain scanner and see what comes up. Bartels and Zecchi were the first to publish. And it was interesting for several reasons. The first was when Zecchi first took a look at the results, he thought, gosh, this looks an awful lot like a person who's high on cocaine. But their work, the really interesting thing that sort of popped up, is they saw all of these sort of pleasure and reward areas that were activated, but they saw the prefrontal cortex deactivated. So if there's a reason for all that crazy behavior when you're in love, why you have such a change in focus and attention, why your lover can do no wrong, this may provide the first hints as to why that is. Very shortly thereafter, Helen Fisher, along with her partners Lucy Brown and Arthur Aaron, did a neuroimaging study. Helen Fisher was sort of inspired by the physical feelings of love, the heart racing, the sweaty palms, just the fact that, you know, when you're in those crazy sort of sex haze days of love, you know, you're messing up all over the place because you're so distracted. So in that case, she thought that there would be neural substrate because of those physical feelings, that actual change to behavior and personality. And when she asked the participants of the study to look at a picture of their beloved and then think of like a romantic time, a more sexy time, and then also just think of a friend, she found that there were three distinct yet overlapping areas, love systems, if you will. One that seemed to correlate to lust, that would be the hypothalamus, which has been shown time and time again in both human and animal studies to be involved with sexual behavior. You knock the hypothalamus out, people are no longer able to have sex, but they're no longer interested in it either. In terms of attachment, so that good friend or thinking about just a lover maybe that you didn't think you were madly in love with anymore, but you really like him a whole lot, activates an area of the brain called the ventral pallidum. It is a reward area. And then there's also a third area of the brain around the nucleus accumbens called the ventral tegmental area that just goes haywire when you think those loving, crazy, romantic thoughts when you're newly in love. Again, it fits the picture. So this idea that there are three sort of separate yet overlapping systems, Helen Fisher told me that they work well together, but often they work not so well together. It explains so many of those sort of crazy situations we find ourselves in. You know, that man who's totally in love with his wife, yet can't stop thinking about that hot coworker of his naked. The woman who's been best friends with a guy for 10 years and all of a sudden looks at him in a totally different way and, you know, wants to tear his clothes off. You know, the fact that you can be so hot and heavy with someone and yet, you know, after 20 years, you just don't have the energy to keep up that kind of mad, passionate dash anymore. So you have this, you know, committed attachment. It makes a lot of sense anecdotally. But I think the best response when I talked about these studies, Stephanie Ortig, who is a researcher at Syracuse University, who did a similar paradigm, but instead with pictures, she did lovers' names. And sort of how people react to lovers' names almost subliminally, you know, it gets your attention right away. And she's just like, well, we saw some of these same areas light up, but I had to ask, so what? You know, we still don't really know why or how. We think that all of these anecdotes work so well. We need to, you know, figure out what we're actually looking at first.
You're tuned in to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking to science writer Kate Sugal about her book, Dirty Minds: How Our Brains Influence Love, Sex, and Relationships. Let's talk about brain chemistry. So what are we working with here?
We're working with a lot. Barry Komisarek, who is actually an orgasm researcher, once talked about the brain to me. It's just a big bag of chemicals. And he thinks it's amazing that can it produce awareness or what have you. But when you start thinking about the neurobiology of attraction, it gets even more complicated. We talk about things like sexual orientation, but we're not really clear what really orients us to another person to begin with. It's not just their sex, because I don't know about you, but if I'm attracted to somebody else, I'm not looking at what they're packing downstairs before I'm looking at the rest of the package. But what's clear is that our brains pick up a lot of signals from another person. Our bodies do not keep a lot of secrets. And without us even being consciously aware of it, we're basically collecting data. We meet somebody in a group and our brain is collecting all kinds of data about their health status, about their immune system, about their age. And most of that is coming through the armpit. So really sort of the seat of attraction, brain, armpit. It's not pheromones, exactly. A human pheromone has yet to be identified, actually, for certain. But there are lots of little chemical messengers that are released through the skin, through the breath, that give us all kinds of really interesting information and ultimately determine who we're going to be attracted to.
Well, how does dopamine work? Well, what does it do neurologically?
Oh, well, dopamine is the pleasure chemical of the brain. If you take a hit of cocaine or meth, your brain releases a lot of dopamine, and it makes you feel good, and it makes you feel high and euphoric. So in terms of love and attraction, dopamine gets released. That's one of the chemicals in the brain that's of interest. I mentioned oxytocin earlier, the so-called cuddle chemical. It's released when you have sex, when you give somebody a hug, when you pet your dog, when you nurse babies. And so this is something that is thought to promote trust and bonding between two people. You also see neurotrophins, particularly brain-derived neurotrophic factor. Scientists refer to this as brain fertilizer because they basically help promote neurogenesis and help sort of change up the brain. It's important to neuroplasticity. Then there's vasopressin, which is involved with monogamous behaviors. You have testosterone, of course, which is, you know, there for maybe sex drive, but maybe some other reason. And then actually researchers in Italy have found that when they look at sort of the brain chemistry of somebody who's newly in love, serotonin goes down.
Now, that was interesting.
Yes. It actually fits with some of the work that's done in Parkinson's disease and other psychiatric disorders, because serotonin, although we think of it as something that's involved with depression and mood and something that you need a lot of so you can have a good mood, it's also viewed as a break for dopamine. You need to have that serotonin there and have the levels up high enough so it can actually, you know, sort of put its foot down and tell dopamine to stop going haywire. So you can have some balance. But it's not clear. It may be that serotonin is going down because you need to have sort of a feeling of, you know, lessened mood. So you push back out and reach out for that person, try to connect more with that person. Or it may be that love is a drive and our bodies lower that serotonin so the dopamine doesn't have a break. So we do get that crazy euphoric feeling, because otherwise we might not get to the baby-making portion of the program. It's not clear, but, you know, a lot of changes are happening. And definitely there are changes that are observed to the brain's natural risk and reward processing circuitry. And I think that's fascinating. But of course, you know, there are some people that say, oh, you want to improve your love life, you know, snort some oxytocin before you go out on a date. You want to attract somebody, use this pheromone spray or this pig pheromone or what have you. But what's clear is that all of these chemicals, sort of like those three separate yet or distinct yet overlapping love systems, they work well together and they work not so well together. They can stand in for one another. They can knock each other out of the way. The communication between two cells in the brain is not just, you know, one chemical messenger moving back and forth. It's more like the Cross Bronx Expressway on July 4th weekend. You have these messengers that are linking up with each other's receptors. They are helping to stimulate the release of more of one and less of another. They're knocking each other out of the way. They're actually, you know, changing up the receptors so only certain chemicals can be accepted. It's really quite wild.
We have an email on that topic from Gabby.
Why aren't there time-release dopamine supplements to help put the spice back into a long-term relationship?
There are. You could just have more sex or new sex or do it yourself. But I don't know that it would help. That's the thing. Dopamine doesn't work in a vacuum. And while I'm sure you could take a little bit for a little while and it might help things up, what you risk is that it dysregulates those other chemicals. So by introducing dopamine from the outside, all of a sudden oxytocin and testosterone or serotonin, those levels that are naturally produced, you have these, you know, sort of endogenous balance that occurs. You mess with that and ultimately hurt yourself in the love department or, you know, in the sexy time department. All of the researchers who work with these chemicals were very clear about you need to think twice before, you know, trying to fool Mother Nature because she's going to outsmart you every time. But the good thing is because they're naturally occurring chemicals, you can do it yourself. So, you know, sometimes faking it till you make it may work out. You know, you want that dose of oxytocin before you go out for a night on the town? Hug your friends, pet your dog, give yourself an orgasm. You want that dopamine? Even if you're sort of having sex that night, turn off Law and Order and do it anyway.
We have a question from J-Matt.
Since the U.S. is suddenly debating the morality of contraception again, do we know what, if any, changes hormonal birth control like the pill makes in the brain?
We're only really beginning to learn some of that. And what it does is it does make changes. It flattens out the woman's cycle. So pretty much all month, it's as if she's in sort of the middle part of her cycle. So studies are now beginning to show that women on the pill are perceived as less attractive than women who are not on the pill. Women who aren't on the pill are more receptive to new partners. There is something about those naturally fluctuating hormones that sort of change. They make little suggestions. They are not deterministic. And I need to say this, I think, like three times. Hormones, chemicals, you know, genes, not deterministic. They can help at different times, you know, sort of allow cells to get more information so that something may seem extra special and tempting, but they do not push any one behavior. You always have the choice to decide in a non-damaged, healthy brain. So what's been very interesting is that some of these researchers, Heather Rupp is one who was formerly of the Kinsey Institute, she doesn't think that you should be on the pill until you're already in a long-term relationship. If you are on the pill, you may miss out on somebody who you'd have great chemistry with, or you may find yourself attracted to somebody who isn't really a good match for you. She's not one of these don't sleep with him on the first date, but she says you're sort of better off waiting to see whether you actually like him after a whole month, after your whole cycle.
Interesting.
And also suggests, you know, wait on the pill. You know, let your body help you unconsciously, you know, wade through all these chemical messages and, you know, give you that gut check about whether somebody's a good match or not.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we'll be right back with Kate Sukel and her book, Dirty Minds. After this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Desiree Schell, and my guest today is science writer Kate Sukel. She's the author of Dirty Minds, How Our Brains Influence Love, Sex, and Relationships. So chemicals definitely play a role in the neurobiology of love, but how about genes?
Yes, And actually, what's not in the book but just came out in the last couple weeks was a study by a researcher there at the Karolinska Institute. His name is Hasse Wollum, and the divorce gene. So in prairie voles, there have been sort of genes for both an oxytocin receptor and a vasopressin receptor that have shown to be important. In fact, when you block these genes, what you find is that animals cannot make a pair bond. So I should probably take a step back and say prairie voles are a monogamous species, a socially monogamous species of rodent. After 24 hours of sex with a partner, they bond for life. And, you know, the dopamine keeps them coming back for one another. And what you find, though, is if you block off these oxytocin receptors, they forget the bond. In fact, they can't even recognize each other anymore. Oxytocin is very important to being able to recognize your partner and your offspring. And then vasopressin, when you block the AVPR1A gene, which is the vasopressin receptors, once again, all of a sudden these monogamous prairie voles, the males, turn into these little Casanovas. And if you up the number of these receptors, so you sort of put that gene into overdrive, the males actually forge a bond without even having to bother with the messy sex part. So you see a pretty direct relationship between the output of this gene and behavior. So, of course, then you think, well, okay, those are prairie voles, so what? But in looking at genome-wide association studies, so Hasse Wollum, who I mentioned earlier, he found that for the AVPR1A gene, human males that had a certain variant of that gene were more likely to be unhappy in their relationships. The studies at the time, the headlines all said, his genes are why he cheats, or this is the infidelity gene. He actually didn't ask any of the subjects about whether or not they had been faithful. So that wasn't true. But they did report more marital crises and report being less happy with their marriages. Just a few weeks ago, he published a paper and it was saying, oh, the divorce gene. This was an oxytocin receptor gene. And in women, he found that they were more likely to be unhappy in their relationships and actually more likely to leave long-term relationships if they had a certain variant called the A allele of this gene. So it's interesting and it's very easy to want to jump on it because there you see these overlaps with the prairie voles. But once again, genome-wide association studies are correlation studies.
Right.
So there is no causality. It's compelling stuff, but, you know, we still don't really understand what, if anything, it could be a totally third variable responsible that's linked to both of them, you know, these genes are actually doing.
And we have many, many emails that are coming in.
That's good, right?
Oh, yes. That's very, very good.
You can just forward the marriage proposals directly to me.
You heard it here first, folks. This is from Bytor.
The studies that have been done on things like women smelling t-shirts that guys have slept in for a week, has any of that made it to well-supported rather than merely curious possibility?
Well, there's actually a girl in Philadelphia who's now running these stinky tea parties. So she's turned it into like a bit of a business venture. There was just a newspaper article about it not too long ago. I think what's really interesting about the stinky tea experiments is that you can guess so much about somebody more than chance. So not only these original studies that showed that by smelling this dirty t-shirt, you found the smell more attractive when somebody had an optimally compatible immune system with yours, but also people have been able to guess more than chance when they smell that stinky tea. If somebody has a sexually transmitted disease, they can guess more often than chance, usually about age. So I don't think it's just possibilities. I think that this is a lot of unconscious information. I don't think that we're meant to sort of take a sniff and be like, obviously, we would have wonderful children together that would be super healthy and survive. But again, I think the important part is our brain is picking up a lot of what other people are putting down and, you know, tallying that data and giving us some information so that more than chance, if we listen to our guts, if we're able to listen to our guts, we're pointed in sort of the right direction.
But again, this goes back to the possibility of pheromones.
Pheromone is more of a semantic debate. So a pheromone in animals is one sort of molecule. So it may be that humans have evolved so that our chemical messages have to be a little more complicated than that. In lower order mammals also, they have what's called a vomeronasal organ. And that's what processes the pheromones. We don't have that. We just have a cavity where past ancestors would have had this VNO. So there's some debate about whether we could even process them. But there have been studies, neuroimaging studies, that show that these pheromone molecules, so like androstenone and some of the estrogens, our hypothalamuses light up when we smell that molecule from the opposite sex. So although pheromones themselves are debated, mm-hmm. and of course, I really sort of am skeptical about whether, you know, spraying yourself with a bunch of boar saliva pheromone is really going to help you in the department, despite all the message boards where people put some pretty down and dirty stories about how lucky they get. Those complex chemosensory messages, our brains do pick them up. So it's not that humans are not affected by smell, that there isn't something in the smells that we get off that are important. It's just debate about, you know, how they're processed and whether it's a single molecule that is a strict sexual attractant. To date, there has not been, you know, one chemical that's like, okay, this is the get lucky molecule. It's a lot more subtle in humans, and there's a lot more to sort of dig through to figure it out.
Well, what about the idea that men's and women's brains are just wired differently?
Well, they are. I realize this is a very controversial subject, and there have been some great books written in the past few years about it. The problem is most people, when they hear different, they hear better.
Right.
And that's not the case at all. I guess when I read this research, one, I'm a mom, and I have a son. So first, I know my downstairs bits are different. So the idea that my brain might be a little bit different doesn't surprise me.
Mm-hmm.
But also, given the amount that my body changed when I was pregnant, the idea of my brain having to be different to facilitate those changes and, you know, making a few changes themselves, it's not – that never sort of made me feel less than or less smart or what have you. It seemed to make more common sense. So it is very controversial. But when you're in the womb, depending on whether you have the old XX or the XY, if you get the XY, you're going to get a – bath of testosterone at a certain point, somewhere between 6 and 12 weeks, that is going to help you develop your penis. A second wave of testosterone is then going to help develop your brain. And there's going to be some circuits in the brain, and some of those involve the hypothalamus, so, you know, sexual behavior areas, but also other areas of the brain that are sexually dimorphic. They're going to be slightly different, and I say slightly, you know, between men and women. And it's important to realize that, of course, every brain is different. So you're going to find a lot more variability within a sex than you are between the two. But still, there are certain areas of the brain that you see significant differences, and they operate differently. And given the input that we see from circulating hormones during the menstrual cycle because of sexual behaviors, I think that makes a lot of sense.
Well, actually, there was an interesting study done comparing brain activity in men and women while doing emotional tasks.
Yes. So the amygdala, home of the fight or flight response, also an area of the brain that is thought to give emotional salience to different situations, that shows different activity during emotional tasks. What's also interesting is that Larry Cahill, who's this great researcher, he sort of discovered by accident that amygdala activation is just different at baseline. So if you put men and women in the fMRI scanner and just tell them to chill out while you get things going, and then compare their brain activation patterns, you actually see different activation in men than you do in women. So it's pretty clear that there are differences. And again, this is not a better or a smarter kind of thing. This is just different. And given that so much of neuroscience to date has not only, you know, just looked at one sex, you know, it hasn't bothered to compare the sexes, I think that this is really an important point that everybody in the neuroscience community needs to pay attention to. So if we go back to your original question, which is about relationships, you know, if we look at evolutionary biology, there's a lot about men and women need to have different mating strategies. There's a lot of discussion about, you know, men wanting to sprinkle their seeds wherever they can and women wanting to wait on a good bet so they don't waste an egg. It may be that there are some underlying systems that sort of help facilitate that. But again, it may be that since it's very hard to tease apart biology from environment, that many of our environmental circumstances, our culture, our day-to-day lives sort of step in and maybe nullify a lot of those differences or exaggerate them. It's something that we need to pay more attention to.
So the jury really isn't in on relationships in the brain.
Right. I mean, I think that there's probably some differences, but this whole idea of, oh, no, women can't have sex on the first date. All this oxytocin is going to be released, and oxytocin is somehow a girl chemical, and she's going to fall in love. Well, anecdotally, we all know that that's not exactly correct, no matter how many rule books are out there. We all have, if not one, several girlfriends that are able to manage that first date sex without, falling head over heels. Mm-hmm. And similarly, we also know those guys. You know, we talk about slut shaming for girls. I think we love shame a lot of guys in our society.
Interesting.
But, you know, I have one guy friend and he just falls head over heels with the slightest provocation. He can't help himself. He is, you know, like that eighth grade boy, crazy girl, except that he's a 39-year-old man, and he likes girls.
Right.
He would want me to point out he likes girls.
Noted.
So, yes.
So again, maybe we don't know all about relationships in the brain, but we do know that sex affects the brain pretty spectacularly. And
yes.
We'll be right back to talk more about that with Dirty Minds author Kate Sukel, and that's here on Skeptically Speaking.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're experiencing the power of stories to communicate science. Join us for Beyond 42, How Science Can Use Stories to Explain Life, the Universe, and Everything. This event, recorded live in Edmonton, features Scientific American blog editor Bora Zipkovich and a fantastic cast of scientists telling moving stories that communicate the wonder of science and discovery. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and I'm talking to science writer Kate Sukel about her book, Dirty Minds, How Our Brains Influence Love, Sex, and Relationships. So Kate, let's talk about orgasms. Yours specifically.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Tell us.
And I like it.
No, I get to say this phrase because I never thought I would get to say this phrase.
Yes.
Kate, can you tell us about your experience masturbating for science?
Yes. So, some people donate money. Some people donate time. I donated my orgasm to science. Barry Komisarek, who is a researcher at Rutgers University, has been trying to plot out the time course of the female orgasm, sort of understand which brain areas are recruited when, as you build up to and then release into orgasm. And it's interesting. I didn't originally plan to participate in his study. But I interviewed him for the book, and the more I spoke with him, I just really couldn't get my head around it. I mean, like, the idea of people masturbating in an fMRI, I was like, how could that apply to the real world? You know, what exactly are they looking at? How can they track it? So it sort of got to the point that my questions were such when I was speaking with him that I realized that unless I sort of put myself out there, I was never going to be able to write about it with any kind of authenticity. So, you know, why not? I was really frightened that I wouldn't be able to do it, but I went and masturbated while they recorded my brain activity. And interesting side tidbit, I actually went back a couple weeks ago and I did it again.
Yay, you.
Even the fMRI calls me back. I'm that good.
That was awful.
Yes, I know.
So what was the goal of the study?
The goal of the study was sort of twofold. There are only about two labs in the world that are studying the orgasm this way, or at least the brain at orgasm. We're very interested in what happens in, the penis and vagina during sex. And those, of course, have been recorded by MRI, but not a lot about what happens in the brain. And you can make the argument, well, you know, the brain seems like it totally dematerializes at orgasm. And maybe if you think back to your last one, you might agree with that statement. But this lab in the Netherlands that is headed up by Janneke Jordis and Barry's lab sort of were having this debate about whether or not there was prefrontal cortex activation during orgasm. The guys in the Netherlands say no. There is not. In fact, that's why it's like a little death. Your prefrontal cortex deactivates, and that's what allows you to have that release. You have to let go of control and top-down ability in order to have an orgasm. Barry's lab, however, has found different things because they've also studied women who can, quote, think off. They are able to bring themselves to orgasm by thought alone.
How did they get any work done?
Actually, I have a girlfriend who can do this. And I only found out after sort of at a dinner party kind of thing. I was like, oh my gosh, you know, women could do that. She's this sort of, you know, buttoned up corporate attorney. And she's like, oh yeah, that's how I get through boring, you know, conference calls at work. So I actually made her show me. And although I was sort of expecting this big When Harry Met Sally kind of moment, it was, you know, kind of buttoned up and like her. But yeah, there are actually a lot of women who can do this. And some people suggest that we may all have the ability to do it. And we're just not taught to. And certainly you do see lots of hands-free orgasms across the lifespan, nocturnal emissions, sex dreams. People who have different parts of brain damage or epileptic seizures often have orgasms without meaning to. Individuals who have spinal cord damage, who can't feel anything below the waist, can often still have orgasms. So when they talk about the brain being the biggest sex organ, as tired and played out as that phrase may be, they're not kidding.
So what does happen to our brains when we orgasm?
It lights up like a Christmas tree. So unlike that whole idea of the brain dematerializing, it's actually getting quite a workout. Areas of the brain from front to back are lighting up. In the original study that I did, over 30 areas, discrete areas of the brain were activated at the point of orgasm. And they included areas that from, you know, genital sensory cortex, nucleus accumbens, and different areas in the basal ganglia that release all that sweet dopamine, and also lots of prefrontal cortex activation. Since that study was published, Komisar's lab has gone on to do others, and they've used a better magnet, so a more state-of-the-art fMRI that has better spatial resolution and also better temporal resolution. So you may remember the video of the female orgasm that went around last year. It was pretty big news, but that showed over 80 discrete areas of the brain. The closest thing that neuroimaging has seen to it is an epileptic seizure.
Fascinating.
And, you know, I get asked a lot, well, what's the point? So what? Well, one, I think it's important because there's so little we know about what normal, you know, sexuality is, given that it's such a motivating force. It's a drive. We might be better off if we knew more about it. But even if we push that to the side in these more Santorum type times, you know, it's important. Some people can't have orgasms. This may be able to help them understand why and give them the right kind of feedback so they can. But also in terms of prefrontal cortex activation and also areas of the brain, pleasure and pain have a lot of overlap in the brain. How is this, you know, so-called big bag of chemicals aware of what's a good touch and what's a bad touch? If we can understand the areas of the brain that are activated during pleasure, they may help with novel pain treatments. They may help us understand how these cells recognize that this is something feels good versus something feeling bad. And it may also help those with mood disorders who are experiencing anhedonia. It's a very common symptom in depression. It's the inability to feel pleasure. And if we really understand how pleasure works, we may see why, you know, disorders like depression and other things are allowing that to occur. So there's a lot more in there besides just the orgasm. And I think once we unlock its secrets, we're going to find it's a lot more important than we ever thought.
We have a question from Monica.
Is there any reason to think that the brain reaction to an orgasm achieved with a partner could be different than when one is flying solo? And would you get back in the fMRI to test that?
Yes and yes. So Barry's lab, it's all self-stimulation. But Jordis's lab in the Netherlands, they do all partnered orgasms. So all of their studies have been in monogamous couples. And, you know, somebody's basically taking care of the business end. So it may be the reason why they're seeing that lack of prefrontal cortex activation is because whoever's actually getting their brain scan can kind of sit back and let the magic happen as opposed to take control of it. That's a possibility. But of course, they also use a different type of scanning called positron emission tomography. It's much slower. It does not have the same kind of resolution as fMRI. So it may be the reason that they don't see it is because they're just not catching it. But Barry's lab is actually starting partnered orgasm studies. He's also starting to look more at the male orgasm. And it'll be really interesting to see what comes out. What I think will probably end up happening is that people who are partnered will still show prefrontal cortex activation, but perhaps not as much as somebody who has to do it themselves. Because although prefrontal cortex is all about, you know, sort of meta and top-down control, it also has a lot to do with, you know, coordinating movements, action selection.
Right.
And so some of that, lots and lots of extra activation may be just because you're taking things into your own hands, so to speak.
We have a question from the chat from David.
I'm not a neuroscientist, but I've seen some neuroscience blogging colleagues look askance at fMRI studies. Obviously, Dr. Komisarek is making great advances. Why is there so much controversy?
So, of course, neuroimaging is a tool. And I think because it's so bright and so shiny and it's giving us this novel glimpse inside our heads, a place that we never really thought we'd be able to go, we sometimes put the tool over the science. Ultimately, it goes back to what Stephanie Ortig said about the love studies. Okay, this is active, so what? This is a correlation. We believe that, you know, for a brain area to be active, it has to be filled with blood. And, you know, that's what we're tracking when we use fMRI. But it's hard to know, especially when you're looking at different analyses that subtract out other things, what are we really looking at? What does it really mean? So gone are the days when somebody could publish a study that just said, hey, this lit up when I did this. Yay! Which is great. So the science is catching up. But I think especially for lay readers, you know, there's just something, pardon the pun, but very sexy about seeing these images. And so we may, you know, sort of take them for more than what they actually are, which is a correlational thing that's telling us that blood is moving into that area. And I think as the technology gets better and we get better at designing studies to work with the technology, we're going to find that it's a great tool. But we still have to ask ourselves with every result, well, so what?
Now, one thing I really do want to talk about is this idea of love as addiction. And this is brought up repeatedly on many of the shows that we've done, actually. So first of all, how exactly is it like an addiction?
Well, they share love and drug addictions share a lot of the same areas of the brain. So that same risk and reward circuitry that allows you to fall in love, make that connection, is the same one that gets knocked out of whack when you become addicted to a substance. There's a fair amount of overlap in neural substrate, but you also see it in terms of dopamine receptors. Several receptors that have been implicated in animal studies, again, for either forging, creating a pair bond, or maintaining a pair bond over time, are the same ones that are implicated in drug seeking and drug satiation behaviors. So some have suggested that, you know, love is the blueprint, this natural system that makes us go out and rewards us with all this great pleasure for connecting with another person, gets hijacked by drugs like cocaine and heroin. And so by learning more about one, we can learn more about the other. Other people have pointed out behaviorally, you know, you never notice it in yourself, but when your best friend falls in love and when she falls into that crazy love, I mean, she's unbearable. Her behavior changes dramatically. You know, all she wants to talk about is, you know, her beloved. She starts missing work. She starts blowing off her friends. She starts making her family angry. She may get involved in, you know, even criminal pursuits. There was just a news story down here where some poor girl was, you know, driving the getaway car after her boyfriend murdered a couple people, and she had no idea. She was just like, he wouldn't do that. I love him so much. So it does sort of, you know, we put on these rose-colored glasses and it can change our behavior. And you can see the same thing in people who are addicted to drugs. They may have been those mild-mannered people, but once they get into the throes of addiction, they start stealing, they start lying, they start hurting people. They have this change of focus and attention as well. So there are overlaps, and I think that there's definitely something to this whole idea of love as a drug. Even going back to Samira Zeki's idea of if we see it in poetry and in song lyrics, then there's a biological truth to it. But, you know, the devil's going to be in the details. And I think moving forward, we're going to see how far those overlaps really apply, how they really extend.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking to Kate Sukel, author of Dirty Minds. And there is honestly so much more in the book that I want to get to, but we are almost out of time, so I'm going to try and get in some audience questions. This one is from Kat.
Does the brain trigger different chemical reactions for men versus women during sex? And are there different chemical reactions between love and lust?
Well, the answer is we really don't know. Unfortunately, sex is not something that gets a fair amount of study. And it's very hard to see, especially in humans, what gets released during sex. You know, if you think masturbating in an fMRI is hard work, imagine if somebody was going to put an EEG cap on you or put some electrodes in your brain while you were getting it on. So the answer is it's not clear. In animal models, you know, female prairie voles do seem to release a lot more oxytocin. That's where that whole idea for women fall in love after having sex one time because of all that release of oxytocin. But what's not often mentioned is that the male prairie voles do too. So there's still a lot to learn about what's released when, how big those sexual differences are. A lot of the science that's coming out now seems to suggest that in terms of subjective feelings about sex, men and women line up a lot more than differ. They tend to have sex for the same reasons. They favor physical attraction more than the other stuff. There's a lot more overlap or a lot more that's the same than different. But whether that plays out with neuropeptides still remains to be seen.
And a question from Colin.
Is there truth behind the idea that men require more visual stimulation for sex and women need more emotional connections?
The answer is, it depends. There have been studies that have shown that men show more brain activation in hypothalamus and amygdala when they look at pornographic material that both the men and women rate as the same level as arousing. They have more activation than the women do. And that sort of gives the idea that, okay, men may be more visually aroused. But when the researchers, and that was Kim Wallen and Heather Rupp, took that study a bit further, when they looked at what the men and women were actually looking at, they found that they were looking at different things. And that may account for those differences in activation in those areas. Men tended to look at women. Women tended to avoid looking at women who were sort of looking straight on out from the picture. Both men and women tended to avoid straight on genital shots, believe it or not. You know, it's still an open question. What's interesting is that sexual imagery makes both men and women's brains light up like crazy. There is something about a sexual image that makes our brains, you know, want to give us a slap and say, hey, you, start paying attention, even despite ourselves. And of course, that's why we see, you know, like those sexual images in advertisements and why I think politicians want to keep talking about sex so much, because it makes us sit up and listen even when we don't want to. And you could make the evolutionary argument that, you know, our brains want to make sure we don't miss any, you know, potential opportunity to propagate the species. But we're still learning a lot. And I think that some of these stereotypes about men and women and sex, they may disappear in light of a lot of the brain science if it moves forward.
And we have time for one more question. This is from Skeptikai in Tokyo.
How will technology like the internet change our psychology in terms of love and lust? I don't mean the obvious changes like dating sites creating more sexual availability, but more uncertain things like Dan Levy's book Love and Sex with Robots, predicting that it will be only 3 or 4 decades before humans are having sex and even marrying robots or good virtual reality devices. Do you have any predictions for how technology might later affect our dirty, dirty minds?
That's interesting. I mean, I think technology is already affecting us. I think there's something about novelty that is incredibly appealing sexually. And so while I agree that we may be out there having sex with robots, I think that they're never going to be a total replacement for that human-to-human contact. There is something in our biology that compels us, that drives us to seek out the company of others. And there is something that is very rewarding and satisfying about doing so. So while it's great to, you know, use our computers for porn or end up with a love doll or a sex robot, I think that that's sort of, you know, something that's off to the side. It's never going to replace that biological urge. So sort of like you may want to, you know, use a sex toy or watch a movie now, it never actually replaces human touch.
With all of the research being done into love, can we expect that at some point we might be able to buy a drug that will make us fall in love or keep us from falling in love more?
Well, about 2 years ago now, Larry Young, who's really one of the biggest names in vasopressin and oxytocin research and prairie vole research, he wrote this essay for Nature saying it wouldn't be too long before we find love potion number 9. And then a very, very enterprising New York Times reporter wrote an essay saying, forget the love drug, I want the love vaccine. Ultimately, it's possible, and some have suggested that, you know, big pharma is already hard at work on it. But the brain doesn't do redundancies. The body has very few redundancies. So vasopressin, although it has been linked to monogamy, it has other jobs as well. It's called vasopressin because it's involved with, you know, blood vessels and vasoconstriction. It's involved in kidney function. So would you be willing to take a monogamy drug at the expense of your kidneys? Your partner might be willing for you to take a drug. But, you know, it goes back, I think, to what Sue Carter said about trying to fool Mother Nature.
Right.
There is a possibility there, but do we really understand what the second and third order effects might be? And I don't think that we do. I've had lots of people write to me and ask, should I take this oxytocin supplement? Should I take this pheromone? And by the way, for the guys, the oxytocin supplement, in something like 20%, if you do snort it, it gives you an erection right away. So you probably want to keep that in mind before you spritz it on yourself before walking in the bar. But you don't know what that's going to do to your endogenous systems. By trying to give yourself a leg up with one situation, you may ultimately ruin it for every other opportunity. So I would be very, very skeptical about a love drug, a love vaccine, a supplement that promises anything, because it's not just one chemical. It's very complex, a very complex cocktail of different chemicals in the brain. And again, you monkey with one and there's really no telling what the second and third order effects will be. And ultimately, they may be very different from person to person. We just don't know yet.
You know, we haven't even got into how your brain deals with monogamy or parenting or how love can make you dumb and all the other wonderful things that you wrote about in your book. But we're out of time. So go buy the book, people. Honestly, highly recommend it. And Kate, thank you very much for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was a lot of fun.
You'll find links to Kate Sukel and her book, Dirty Minds, on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, click the links to Facebook, to Twitter, and to Google+, so that you can keep up with show news, and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to our program or listen to our wonderful past episodes. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking. I'm here with Bill Lidgerwood, one of the organizers of Imagine No Religion in Kamloops, British Columbia. So tell us about the conference.
We have a great lineup of speakers this year. It's actually a little over 2-day event this time. We've got a great lineup of speakers headed by Dr. Lawrence Krauss. And we also have PZ Myers, Matt Dillahunty, Joyce Arthur, Miriam Namazi, who we're very excited about bringing in. She's coming all the way from London. Then we have Dr. Christopher DiCarlo as well. Dr. Andy Thompson, who is with the Richard Dawkins Foundation. He's a psychiatrist from Virginia. And Seth Andrews, who some people may know as The Thinking Atheist. He does a lot of really cool video and audio work. He also has a podcast. A gentleman by the name of August Berkshire, and David Eberth, who is a paleontologist from Lethbridge.
Oh, lovely.
IRL Museum.
So ended.
Oh, sorry, there's one more. Mm-hmm. I forgot. Desiree Schell.
Actually, I had forgotten about myself there.
She's the host of Skeptically Speaking.
And I will actually be there talking about activism.
Yes, and we're looking forward to seeing you, for sure.
And so that's May 18th to 20th at the Kamloops Convention Center. So where can people go to find more information?
They can go to the website, which is imaginenoreligion2.com. and they can get all the information they need there, including speakers, hotels. They can register there. I should mention, by the way, that people that are CFI members, that's members of CFI Canada, they're offering a pretty significant discount, so they should check that out. That's also on the website. And there's also free daycare available for anyone that needs it, and that's being provided by the Richard Dawkins Foundation, being funded by them, I should say.
That's really good to hear.
Yeah, we're really looking forward to it, and we're hoping we can get a lot more, you know, single parents, single women, and families to come out because of that. So I think it's going to be a great time, and there's a lot of power in being in a room with 200 other people that think the same as you do.
There is. Well put, sir.
Thanks.
And I'm very much looking forward to it myself. And thanks for being here.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically, that is. 'Cause we're skeptically speaking.